The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The USA win the World Cup. Megan Rapinoe and Rose Lavelle confirm what we already knew, that the US women are better than everyone else. How much better? Will they be better forever? And will they go to the White House? Elsewhere, England rightly lose the pointless third place playoff with one of those handball VAR things. Also, Brazil win Copa America, but they were always going to, according to Lionel Messi, while Mexico win the Gold Cup. Madness in AFCON as Morocco, Cameroon and Egypt all go out. And good to know the season is almost done for all of us and we can relax until it all starts again on Tuesday, when Celtic and Rangers get their European campaigns underway. We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Tim Stillman, how are you?
Not too bad, thank
nice
you.
Nice to see. It's almost like, are you now contracted for every pod that we ever do from now on?
I think so, yes. I think you're going to struggle to get rid of me.
Good. You just concentrate on the next pod and then just see what happens, I guess. Louis says, did I see Lars Sivertsen outside Lewisham Asda last Tuesday morning?
No.
Okay.
No chance.
Okay. Where were you last Tuesday morning?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, the plot thickens.
But not in Lewisham. I'm very confident of that.
DK says, on the 10th of October 2018, Glenn Denning was included in a list of the 238 most respected journalists working in Britain, as published by the National Council for the Training of Journalists. He was number 238. Does Barry think he can make the top 225 this year?
That list was alphabetical.
Okay.
So there's no way of knowing how highly or lowly I ranked.
Okay.
I'm saying I was top 10.
Right. And have you done anything this year to maintain your respected status?
I am unaware of what I did to garner that status in the first place. So I'm just going about my business and we'll hope for the best.
Oh, excellent news. Well, good luck to you. Let's start then with the World Cup final, shall we? USA 2. Netherlands 0. We always knew it was going to happen. Tim, did anything surprise you in this game? The Netherlands holding out for as long as they did or anything?
That's precisely what surprised me, yes. The US had scored in the first 12 minutes of every game at this tournament up until the final. But actually what was really surprising was Netherlands, who famously, Serena Weigman, the coach, never changes personnel, never changes tactics under any circumstances, completely changed her tactics for this game. And Netherlands went for kind of a 4-4-1-1 formation. They played Vivian Miedema as a number 10. They put Danielle van der Donk out on the right to kind of help contain Megan Rapinoe. And actually, I think it was quite a good plan for the Netherlands. They're the inferior team and they played like it. I didn't think their coach was capable of doing something like that, to be honest. But I thought it really surprised the US.
Isn't that what Phil Neville tried to do?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, except he kind of played Nikita Paris, the fast centre forward, as a number 10. And he played Ellen White as number 9, understandably, whereas Netherlands reversed that and played Miedema as a number 10 and just put their fastest player up front, which made some sense. But I think once that first goal went in, it was all over. That's the problem with a game plan like that. When you go 1-0 down, it's obsolete.
Do you think then that the coach maybe looked at what Phil Neville had done and gone, that's a really good plan if it works?
I have my doubts, right, to be honest with you. I think a lot of it was more about putting Danielle van der Donk on the right because she's quite a feisty competitor. And I think a lot of it was about containing Megan Rapinoe and just having that extra, like having four in midfield instead of three, made a bit of a difference. But I mean, ultimately, USA are just a better team and that's what showed.
Lars, the first goal, as Tim mentioned, that's obviously crucial. The penalty, Alex Morgan fouled by Stephanie van der Gracht. I am surprised, when I was on social media yesterday, which is obviously no barometer or anything, that people were trying to tell me that that wasn't a penalty.
Were they demonstrating it in the studio?
There were no demonstrations.
Because I mean, it's similar but more extreme, right? I mean, she's gone for the ball, not got much of the ball, and ended up kicking the player in the shoulder.
But not got any of the ball.
Yeah, not got at all. And you're not really allowed to kick people in the shoulder. So I thought it was a really good example of good VAR, because it didn't take a long time. The angle of the incident was such that it was really hard for the ref to see, whereas when you saw it on the video, it was a clear penalty. So I thought that was a textbook VAR there. And, yeah, you know, it's fine. What I enjoyed about the Dutch approach, I agree with everything Tim said, obviously, but also, like, they were quite physical. Like, they really got stuck in, and you can see the American players didn't like that so much, which is interesting given that they're not, they're quite a physically in brash and sort of in-your-face type of team, but they got a couple of, like, really quite sort of nasty challenges back, and it was getting under their skin a little bit, I thought, a couple of times.
Yeah, Hope Solo said earlier in the tournament, particularly about Alex Morgan, if basically if you foul her, she's kind of out of the game, and I think the Netherlands took that to heart a little bit in the first 20 minutes.
She diver? Is she a diver?
I think maybe a little bit.
Oh, she definitely has a dive in her locker, all right.
Yeah, yeah. I think perhaps in the men's game it would be skated over a bit more. I think that in the women's game there's this whole, oh, they don't dive kind of thing, which is actually not really true. I think that in the men's game she might be called clever.
Yeah, I think she's doing what, like, 99% of centre-forwards in the men's game do, which is any time you feel some kind of contact in the box, you go down. And part of the reason you do that is because the refs won't give it if you stay on your feet. I mean, I didn't make the point on the pod because it didn't really matter, but when England knocked out Norway, I mean, we should have had a penalty. Elias Meliutland went past the goalkeeper. Goalkeeper didn't get the ball. There was a clear touch on her. She was impeded in her efforts to get at the ball, but she stayed on her feet instead of going down, and we didn't get a pen. Now, we would have gone out anyway, so I didn't want to make a big stink about it on the pod.
But you appear to be making a big think about it on the pod.
But it's the general point is that we can't expect forwards to stay on their feet when referees punish them for doing so.
But I suppose
you are costing your team a goal if you don't go down,
basically. I suppose what's interesting is I don't feel that many of the women's players do that. Like, Alex Morgan is clearly clever. She knows what she's doing. She's a very, very good footballer, and she's doing what I would expect her to do. But
well, I think as well as being better than all the other teams, USA, I think, are noticeably more streetwise than all the other teams. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what it is.
And you saw that in the last 10 minutes of the England game, the way they drew the sting out of it, their front three kind of, you know, as Lars says, feeling the contact and going down. And that, again, that's just kind of textbook in elite level football.
Hmm. The second goal, Roosevelt, was beautiful goal, isn't it? Lovely, lovely run, lovely finish.
And it was great for her to have like a big moment because she's kind of been low key one of the best players of the tournament.
See, I heard everyone saying she's been one of the best players in the tournament, and I hadn't really noticed her.
Yeah, low key bit.
Yeah. But is that just I'm not very good at watching football matches?
It's just because when you watch the US, all the attention will understandably go to the front three, right? Because they're really good in different ways and they're sort of big characters and you notice them. But she's done a great job in sort of connecting midfield and attack and a really strong runner with the ball. Tracks back well as well. You know, she has a lot going for her.
Yeah, the USA's midfield, I think, is every bit as good as their front three. They've got four really top-class players to play in those three positions. Like, Lindsay Horan can't get in the team, and many people consider her to be one of, you know, be the best player in the world at the moment, and she can't get into that midfield three. And I think what you've really seen in this tournament is USA just dominate teams through that midfield three. They know when to drop off, they know when to take control and take possession. They're really good at reading the kind of thermometer of the game.
Is there anyone else in the US team who's had a brilliant tournament that I have also failed to notice?
Well, we just mentioned the midfield, but specifically, I think the way Julie Ertz sort of finds space and switches play, she's a really clever sort of midfield schemer at the base midfielder.
And they drop her into the back line quite a lot as well. Mm. When they go 1-0 up, Julie Ertz kind of drops into the defence and they make it a back three, and it's incredibly effective. It's sometimes not that interesting to watch, but it gets them over the line.
I have been appalled by your outrageous anti-Tobin Heath bias throughout this tournament, but I didn't want to say anything about it. I was just wondering why you were ignoring her
hatred
for fine performances.
I thought Crystal Dunn was excellent again, and she has had a very good tournament, and noticeably so from my point of view.
Yeah, and there were lots of question marks over her because she's not really a left back. And so earlier in the tournament, lots of teams were saying, lots of kind of pundits were saying, myself included actually, maybe this is where you can get at the US. But she really came into her own, particularly when they started playing better teams like France, like England, like Netherlands. She just had that kind of that spot on lockdown, to use an Americanism. I mean, she's a fantastic player. She's not a left back, but she really looked like one.
What does this do for US football? Because their league is not that strong, is it? Or is it?
It's quite strong. It's been kind of mismanaged over the years. That's the kind of thing. It's more that, like, the players are strong,
right?
But the administration is perhaps not that strong, and there's already complaints about them failing to capitalise commercially, that they don't really have, you know, the commercial, the muscle, the kind of the staff there to really drive this forward. So yeah, and of course their domestic league is going on at the moment. It was going on during the World Cup. There were games being played, and so there's a bit of tension at the moment because lots of these players, their clubs want them back, but the US Soccer Federation kind of wants to send them on a bit of a victory tour. So there's a little bit of tension there
and
as well.
And it's more like, you know, the England cricket team, they're centrally contracted to the US before yep. their club, right? Which yep. is the reverse to most European teams.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nathan says, why don't more US women play in Europe? Would a combined 11 of Europe's elite beat the US team?
So they don't, because the US Soccer Federation doesn't really, kind of strongly discourages them from doing it.
Okay.
What you see is in the international cycle, there's kind of one year where there's not a tournament, and then you see some of them go. So Alex Morgan had a little spell at Lyon, Crystal Dunn was at Chelsea, Heather O'Reilly came to Arsenal. So 1 year out of every four, some of them do come to Europe, but the US Soccer Federation is very, very, kind of very strong on them staying in the US and kind of not threatens them, but kind of says, oh, well, if you went to Europe, you know, maybe you'd lose your place in the US team.
Would they get more money playing in Europe?
Possibly, but they get paid for playing for their country as well, so overall, probably not.
You mentioned them getting paid to play for their country. There is this ongoing equal pay dispute. I listened to Hope Solo talking about how she has, you know, personally sacrificed a great deal for that to happen. And they're coming to a position where the US women teams may settle or they may not settle. And that's a big moment for women's football, probably around the world, but definitely in the United States. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And theirs is quite a unique case because there's lots of evidence to show they take in more revenue than the men's team. They're certainly more successful, but usually the argument kind of against equal pay for women's footballers is, well, it's not as popular, it's not as commercially successful. That's not true with the US. Their shirt was the biggest selling shirt on the Nike website this year, of all time, actually. So they've got the commercial argument as well. And actually, I think it's the US Soccer Federation who really want to settle this out of court, because if mediation doesn't sort it out and it does go to court, I think they've got a really strong case. And the US team have shown before they'll be willing to go for industrial action, I'm sure.
Grant says, could this please be analysed on the pod? It is the Bleacher Report's hashtag One Nation, One Team photo of the US women's team. It's a sort of painting or a drawing.
It's incredibly weird.
With some famous American faces behind it. So here you can see it. There it is, Barry. It's Megan Rapinoe at the front with the rest of, and Alex Morgan and the rest of the US team behind them. Ellen DeGeneres is there. Brad Pitt, Oprah, I can see. Will Ferrell in the back with Will Smith and someone from Iron Man. I'm not sure if that is Iron Man. The red one with the golden face.
Chandler from Friends as well.
Yes.
But isn't he Canadian? I always thought Matthew Perry was Canadian.
Maybe. Well, all of Friends, actually. They're all there. Steve Carell. Can anyone explain what on earth this is?
I thought it was one of Cold War Steve's. kind of spoofs at first.
Totally amazing. What do the rest of the world need to do to catch up with the US? Is it that street wide? I tend to agree with you, Barry, that...
Well, there's a first.
I tend to think if the other sides become more streetwise, and I almost felt some of them becoming more and more during the tournament, that is a big part of it. And fitness as well is everything, right?
Yeah, and the fitness question is kind of compromised a bit by the fact that the US players are right at the beginning of their season and European players are right at the end. I think what's happened is that Europe as a continent is moving closer to the US, but the talent is spread out. So there isn't one team who's pooled enough talent to take them on. If you did, we had the question a couple of weeks ago about Lyon.
Yeah.
Lyon would have had a good go at winning the World Cup, I think, and beating this team, because Lyon is kind of a Europe All-Stars. So a Europe All-Stars against the USA, I think, would be a really interesting matchup.
The Ryder Cup.
Yeah, exactly. But at the moment, there's just not one team who has enough talent.
I thought you were about to say something, Barry.
No.
You were just like a coiled spring waiting for my yoghurt pots for hats question. It'll come, don't worry. Well, in the third, fourth playoff game, Sweden beat England 2-1. Aslani and Jakobsen with the early goals. Frank Kirby got one back. Ellen White had one disallowed for handball by VAR. I couldn't work out if that was a handball. Laws, Lars, please.
The Ellen White one. I'm just looking up Matthew Perry. It seems he holds dual citizenship.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah, that's important.
But it, well, you know, it is. You got to get the Canadians. We got to make it. No, I. You know what? Jackie Oakley, as always, was on hand to explain why, what the laws say about it, which they specify the new laws very clearly that if you score a goal after having controlled the ball with your arm, it has to be ruled out. I don't know, that was one that annoyed me a little bit, because it's a very marginal call. They're both kind of jostling for the ball, and it bounces around a little bit, and maybe it touches her arm. I mean, even as me being a bit of a stickler for the rules, I wouldn't have minded if that had stood, to be honest.
You were saying just before the pod that Mike Riley has come out and gone renegade.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
What's he saying about season?
I think they're sort of low-key extraordinary, the quotes, because he said, this is Mike Riley talking, I actually think handball is in a really good place in this country, and that's the message that we get from all the clubs, from the managers and the players when we go talk to them. We have a philosophy that says we want handball to be something that has an impact on the game. We're not looking for the ball to be striking arms, and we do accept when we're looking at what's an unnatural position for the arm, that arms move. We don't expect players to defend with their arms behind their back, nor do we expect forwards to try to drill the ball into the hand to win a free kick. The way we've actually implemented handball for the past two or three seasons is the way we're going to continue to do it in the future. Now, that's an outlandish thing to say when there's just been a major law change. Like, you can't say, we're really happy with the way we've been doing handball. Like, there has been a major change this summer, but we're just going to continue.
It's like Brexit for handball.
It's basically very odd. Like, and I, like, personally, have said a bunch of times in the pod, I think the new laws are really stupid, and I hate them. But I also don't think it's a great idea for individual countries to just kind of decide which laws they like.
Because
like, tomorrow, Austria decide that the back pass thing is just not for them. Like, I mean, we have to actually follow the laws, right?
They do appear to be cherry-picking which laws they're going to adhere to and which they can sort of sweep under the rug, because they've said as well that the penalties, goalkeepers moving off the line of penalties, isn't going to be a thing in the Premier League.
I also like the phrasing of it's sort of like, you know, if you're in a dysfunctional relationship but you're trying to salvage it and you say, I think we're in a good place. That's what Mike Riley is with handball. We're in a really good place here, guys. Keaton does say on the laws subject, how many rounds would Lars survive against Jackie Oakley if they were both to be a part of a laws debate? Lars can have his PDF open on his laptop.
None at all. She's great.
Okay. Now, Phil Neville said, well done to Sweden, but it's a nonsense game. Ollie says, at what minute did the third place playoff become a nonsense match? He's got a bit of criticism for this comment. He's sort of since clarified it a little bit, saying, actually, you know, that we wanted to win it and we didn't win it. And I mean, I sort of sympathise with him here. Does anybody?
I mean, I just don't think you can say before the game that you think it's really important and then you lose it and then you say it's a bit of a nonsense game, right? I mean, you look like a bit of a tit.
I think as well, as the coach of Team GB at the next Olympics, you should be more informed about why the third place playoff happens in the World Cup. It wasn't required for this purpose on this occasion, but obviously the World Cup is linked to Olympic qualification, so the reason the game exists is just in case they need to decide which team from which federation actually goes to the Olympics. And if he's going to coach Team GB, maybe he should have been aware of that.
But before the game, he said, I want to send a message to my players that this game is important. We do have certain positions where we will need to freshen up, but my players know that there are no illusions. This game is one we want to win. I want to be lying on a sunbed next week, happy that we've finished the tournament well and not finished with two defeats. So we're picking the strongest team to win. The players, I feel, will have enough to beat the Swedish team. And like, if you go from that and then you lose and then you say, it's a nonsense game, like, you look like a prat. Like, even though I kind of agree that it is a nonsense
game. He said
game.
He wasn't disrespecting the game. I mean,
no, I'm sure he wasn't, but, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
Just pick one of them, right? Either it's important to win it or it's nonsense.
Yes, but before the game, it's very hard to say, I don't want to be here and I don't want to play this game. Or I would have more respect, I guess, if he'd said that.
Because I have a lot of sympathy for the English team. Like, they felt they were in the tournament to win it, and it's been mentioned so many times. In my opinion, we've talked too much about winning it. So then when you do go out against the US and you have to get yourself back up again for this game, that's very hard psychologically. So I don't think you should trash them too much for not winning it, but it's just a bit of an odd look.
Tim, you really think he's useless, don't you?
Yeah, actually. So I do think England have stalled under Phil Neville a little bit. I think the thing is with Neville, first of all, they're so inconsistent under Neville, and I thought they looked a lot better before he took over. But also, yeah, I just think there's just so much like filibuster from him. There's so much kind of, he contradicts himself all the time. And one minute he's saying, oh, we're always true to our style. And then he says, no, I rotate because we have different styles. And have you ever interviewed someone for a job and within 2 minutes you just think, you're just saying a load of things that you think someone who has this job would say? That's just, I can't shake that with Phil Neville. I'm an Arsenal fan, so I never liked him, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to shake that clear bias that I have, but there's just something that just doesn't, he sends out a lot of mixed messages to me, and this one was like a prime example.
I'm sure he will do a sort of post-season evaluation of himself as well, and I wonder if maybe keeping his cool a bit in front of microphones will, because I also, listening to the post-match interview, it was done immediately after the game, before he'd had time to think, probably cross about not winning the game, so I'm not sure in his heart of hearts, if he'd had a think, he would have said that it was a nonsense game. I think it's just one of those things.
I never really watched the England women's football team before the reign of Phil, and so I'm not in a position to know whether they have improved or not. So Tim obviously is, and he reckons they've stalled, and that's quite interesting, because for the amount of resources that are being put into them, that should not be happening, and someone needs to be held accountable, I suppose.
His supporters say he's changed the style of football. Is that true or not, that we try and play out from the back?
I mean, they don't have a style, really. There's the whole kind of playing out from the back thing, although he doesn't pick the best defenders that can actually do that anyway, so I'm not really sure what that's... I feel like that's the only thing, and actually that's a really small thing that most teams do anyway. I'm not convinced he has changed the style, or if he has, he's changed it to not really having a style at all.
Karen Carney's retiring after this World Cup, 143 games, 32 goals. Only Farrah Williams has played more for her country. Did she get enough game time this tournament?
I don't think so, personally, and I don't think out of sentiment. I think she's just... We talked about the US being really canny and streetwise, and Karen Carney is very canny and streetwise player. She shouldn't be starting every game, particularly at this point, well, of her career, which is now over. But I think definitely from the bench, she would have been a really good substitute to have. She's been an excellent player for several clubs, and someone who's hugely revered within the squad as well.
And what about the future? Are there players coming through? Will the Olympic squad, it's obviously smaller, and you've got to bring in, we don't have to, but we'll probably bring in a couple of Scots and a token Welsh. Will there be a token Welsh person or not?
But maybe not, because Jess Fishlock is the only one who'd really trouble it, and she's just injured her cruciate. So, but yeah, it's. I mean, there's plenty of cover where Karen Carney plays. She kind of plays out wide, and England have got lots of talent.
But just in general, like if we're looking at the Olympics and then the Euros, will the England squad look?
It will look roughly the same, right? Yeah, okay. I think so.
Paul says, is playing WSL games with Premier League games really a good idea? It will likely lead to games being played in largely empty stadia, as the attitude by most men I speak to is arrogant about the standard. Surely smaller packed-out stadiums is a better way. Go for a younger and diverse crowd. This is the idea of maybe playing games on the same day. Certainly using, you know... Premier League stadiums for some WSL games?
Yeah, I've spoken to quite a few players about this through the years, and a lot of them don't really like it, just from a pure footballing perspective, playing in front of like a fairly semi-engaged audience in a half-empty stadium. A lot of them kind of say, let's fill out the stadiums we have, but this is a step towards doing that, and I think really something has to happen, and I think it's worth a try. I'm not sure how the logistics will work vis-a-vis tickets and things like that, but I think they've got to do something at the moment, and this is as good a suggestion as any.
I suppose what you could do is you could have a couple of games a year, like some big derbies and some that you target long in advance, and you market them heavily, free tickets for local schools, all this sort of thing, and make a really big effort to get a lot of people in, but just do it a handful of times a year.
Izzy Christensen was saying, actually, the nice thing about playing at those stadia is the pitches are really, really good, and that encourages quick football, and they're not always playing on great pitches. Yeah, that seems really basic, right?
Yeah, precisely. You look at, like, Liverpool women were playing at Tranmere Stadium last season. I went there for for when they played Arsenal women, and the pitch was dangerous, basically. There was like a big trench down one of the touchlines. And I think I spoke to Daniel van der Donk about it afterwards, and she, as always, was left me in no doubt about what she thought about playing on a pitch like that. But yeah, that's definitely would be a big plus.
Do you have a direct quote from van der Donk? She's quite potty mouth, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. I can't remember it off the top of my head. There probably was. The first time I interviewed her, she kind of swore, and I said, "Oh no, it's fine. Like, we don't mind that on our site." And she's kind of taken that very to heart.
A bit like Jamie Carragher. Was it on Norwegian or Danish TV?
Yeah, I think he had a stint with us there, where he went a bit sweary.
And they were, no, because they were on air, and someone said to Jamie, "You know, God, what did you make of that? What did you make of that crap or something?" He went, "Can you swear on this?" And they went, he went, "Yeah, sure, you do what you like." So he just looked down the camera and went, "Shit." Like a teenage boy. Anyway, before we finish on the Women's World Cup, we should mention Megan Rapinoe, right? Who's sort of the star of the tournament before she was named player of the tournament. And yeah, she's a fantastic player on and off the pitch.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure she's been the best player per se. I think that might have been Rose Lavelle. But if you're looking at, but we all know that's not how player of the tournament is decided. The diligent central midfielder doesn't win player of the tournament. And if you're looking at the most iconic player, definitely Megan Rapinoe. And you look at the way she's taken four penalties in the knockout stages, absolutely nerveless every single time. And yeah, I think the prevailing images, if you're putting together a montage of this tournament, then Megan Rapinoe would feature very heavily.
And Chandler from Friends. Yes.
I mean, she's done so whilst, incurring the wrath of dim-witted loons everywhere by standing up for equality and that sort of thing, which seems to get some people very, very troubled. So that's very good. And also, like, I mentioned it before, she's 34 and she's had three serious ACL injuries in her career. Like, getting to 34 and playing at a World Cup when you've been through that is quite extraordinary as well.
I mean, I wonder where she goes next.
Well, she'll probably play in the Olympics next year. And then at which point she'll be 35, so she'll be legally allowed to run for president at that point. So that might be an interesting next
imagine. And Lucy Bronze came, got the silver, what's it called, the silver?
Bronze got the silver golden ball.
Bronze got the silver golden ball. Did she deserve that?
Again, I'm not entirely convinced. I think she's not like massively undeserving. I think it's a little touch of she's one of the most famous players, but I'm not sure she was that great in the semi-final. But, she's a fullback and fullbacks don't exactly get all the plaudits.
No, that's true. Oh, well, are there any other players in the tournament that we should highlight? Actually, we didn't really mention the Dutch goalkeeper in the final, who was absolutely superb. Wasn't she? She had an absolutely fantastic
game. Sari van Wienen, though.
Exactly, yeah. Is there anyone else we should pick out?
A last mention for Ellen White, just being brilliant. Like, of all the England players I've really enjoyed watching, I love a canny finisher, and she certainly is that. And I actually, we got a tweet on this. I forget who it was from, but someone pointed out that actually, if there was a tie on goal-wise, I mean, Ellen White should maybe have gotten this because I don't think she'd taken any penalties.
No, true. She got the VAR golden boot, I'm sure.
Well, 40% of all disallowed goals have been scored by Ellen White, so that's something. But I as a tiebreaker for the golden boot, I like the idea of the player of the tie who scored the fewest amount of penalties. I think that makes sense. But,
I should say the BBC's coverage, I thought, was pretty good, actually. And I thought Hope Solo and Emma Hayes, absolutely brilliant pundits. At the start, I was really impressed with Hope Solo, and then I wondered if she just went on air and just annoyed people in a sort of shock jock way. But actually, I've been really, really impressed with her. And they make a brilliant montage, don't they? At the end of the World Cup, you just think, oh, that is a great montage.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hope Solo, I think, had been on Irish TV maybe last year or for the Euros or something like that, and really impressed. I felt the same when I saw her. I thought, because she's always been very controversial and outspoken, I thought, oh, this will be fun. But I agree, actually, I perhaps did her a disservice by thinking that, because while she is quite outspoken, I think she is actually a really kind of quality broadcaster. I think she's really brought something to the coverage of the tournament.
I think there's maybe this is a cultural difference thing, but like punditry in this country, there are certain lines you don't cross in terms of criticism, and she kind of crosses them on a routine basis, and it kind of catches you off guard a little bit.
Yeah, that is actually really interesting that no one ever says, oh, I don't really like them.
Or, yeah. Yeah, it goes back
really
to the,
they're not really very sort of, good, you know.
Like the initial sort of Jill Ellis criticism of her, like, crumbling under pressure, and this is not something you'd ever say about a coach in this country ever. But it's refreshing. And a last shout out to Jackie Oakley, not just because I'm a stickler for the laws myself, but I think, you know, she's taken the time to actually learn them and try to communicate them. And this is just going forward when we're going to have VAR in England, which I'm dreading, to be honest, because it's still, like, under-communicated how the system actually works. There are a lot of people, even in broadcasting, who don't seem to understand the laws on a very basic level, and we're going to have this complete chaos. It feels like we're tied to the railroad tracks, and there's this sort of freight train of tedium heading towards us, and it's going to hit us all in a big way in the first couple of rounds of the Premier League season. It's going to be no fun at all. And if all the broadcasters were as diligent as Jackie in actually learning and explaining how the laws work, I think it would be less painful for everyone.
The two of you could do a workshop. I'd come.
I think they're doing something about that. I'm aware at the end of July, I think it's IFAB are doing like some big VAR workshops. I know I got invited to one. I can't make it, unfortunately. But hopefully that will kind of help educate broadcasters and viewers alike.
I've been tweeting IFAB quite a lot. They're yet to respond to me with all my law changes. And just before we finish, are there any other highlights from the tournament? When Thailand scored that goal, that celebration... And being sort of educated about it's Noel Phan Lamsam, you know, who has basically completely run and sort of funded Thai football, was a beautiful moment. I don't know if there are any others that spring to mind.
That overall, the goalkeeping was really good, which would have been like a myth buster for a lot of people. I thought that there's so many like really good goalkeeping performances. I enjoyed, they lost in the end, but like Jamaica's young goalkeeper, Sidney Schneider, when they played Brazil, had a tremendous game. The Chilean goalkeeper was very good.
Argentinian goalkeeper.
A lot of good goalkeeping performances.
I don't think it's a myth buster, though, because I don't think it's a myth that the standard of goalkeeping was largely quite poor in previous tournaments.
No, this is the first tournament where a lot of these goalkeepers have had goalkeeping coaches. Yeah. So even at 2015, the vast majority wouldn't have had access. And you look at the Chilean goalkeeper, Christiane Endler, she had a brilliant tournament. She plays for PSG, so she's a professional and she has access to daily coaching. And I think that's
obviously
going
to make a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start with the Copa America. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Brazil won the Copa America overnight. They beat Peru 3-1. Tim, put your South American football expert hat on. I mean, they deserved to win. And Gabriel Jesus had he got sent off. So he set up the first game. He had a strange game. He had a decent tournament, didn't he?
He did. He had a brilliant tournament. His role is really misunderstood for Brazil, actually, because usually when he plays, his role is about making space for Neymar. So lots of people got hung up on him not scoring at the last World Cup, but neither did Olivier Giroud. And they kind of do similar things in a different way, but he was exceptional. They've been playing him down the right in this tournament. And there's two things that I think a lot of people in this country don't know about Gabriel Jesus. One, that he started as a wide forward and only moved up front about 6 months before he moved to City. The second one is that he's actually really easy to wind up. He got a few red cards when he was playing for Palmeiras. And he's really... I think somewhere he knows he's really got to improve is his leash on his emotions. And I don't think Premier League defenders have worked this out, but South American defenders definitely have.
Who knew that South American defenders would do such a thing? Shane says, what do you think of his reaction to his red card? I thought he was unlucky because he sort of jumped into someone. It wasn't... Was it a yellow? I mean, he jumped in. He sort of hit him with his side.
So. I thought he knew what he was doing. Really? And previous to that, his first yellow was a dark yellow. That could have been a red. And I think he'd been told to calm down a couple of minutes before. So you could see he was kind of losing it.
Do we believe Brazil were the best team in this tournament?
Yeah. Yeah, they conceded one goal and that was a penalty in the final. And that was another one of these handballs where Thiago Silva is penalised for having a hand.
Which is wrong. I mean, that sort of incident was super wrong because it's specifically mentioned in the new laws that shouldn't be a penalty. Or kind of. It's very unhelpful, again, because these new laws are very dumb. It says, and I'm quoting the rule books again, It's usually not an offence if the ball touches the player's hand or arm. When a player falls and the hand arm is between the body and the ground to support the body, but is not extended laterally or vertically away from the body. Which is, so basically, when you go down to block a shot and the arm is between you and the ground and it hits your arm, it shouldn't be a pen, which is clearly what the defender was doing. But then wording it like it's not usually an offence makes it completely stupid, because that means the ref can do whatever he wants. I just kind of thought, given all the conspiracy theories Messi have put into the world, it was quite good to see a dodgy decision go against Brazil, just to clear it up that they're either they're playing a really long game or they're not bent, they're just incompetent.
Barry, do you reckon Lars, like at dinner parties, do you know when people get to dinner parties, they're sitting just next to Lars on the end and they're like, how was
you,
how
you
was
know that freight train of tedium he was talking about earlier? I feel like I've just been, it's just rolled over me.
Anyone's listening.
And now it's reversing back.
Just in case anyone else, you know, listening, zoned out during that last bit of Lars discussions. I also did. I don't know about you, Barry. I mean, Tim's too polite. Interestingly,
it's,
I mean,
it's just no wonder people are confused by the handball law if they can't even, like, that's just one of the bits. And it's an interesting bit because it's really dumb.
No, it really is.
I mean, thankfully, there was a pointless third, fourth playoff game in this competition, because actually there are many more news stories coming out from that game than the final. Messi claimed the competition was corrupt after he was sent off. I mean, to be fair, he was an absolutely glorious red card. He was sent off for being headbutted by Gary Medel. Messi says, the cup's fixed for Brazil. We don't have to be part of this corruption. They've showed us lack of respect throughout the tournament. Sadly, the corruption, the referees, they don't allow people to enjoy football. They ruined it a bit, he says. CONMEBOL released a statement which did not directly refer to Messi, but it said, a fundamental pillar of fair play is to accept the results with loyalty and respect. It's unacceptable that as a result of incidents typical in competitions involving 12 teams, all on equal terms, unfounded accusations have been launched that lack the truth and question the integrity of the Copa America. These accusations represent a lack of respect for the competition, all the participating players, and the hundreds of professionals of CONMEBOL. Thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is Messi's, perhaps his mic drop on his international career, and he just doesn't really care anymore. I think corruption's a big word to use. I think maybe incompetence, refereeing incompetence. He's right to be angry about two penalties that Argentina weren't awarded against Brazil in the semi-final. He's got a right to be aggrieved about the sending off, which I think was totally about his comments about referees. That was a little bit of own back from the match official.
But there is VAR, right? Because anybody who sees that sees Gary Medel, who has quite a terrifying head anyway. Like, headbutts Messi, and Messi, to be... Messi should have just gone down in a heap, right? He doesn't. He stays on his feet.
Exactly. And had he gone down clutching his face, there's no way he'd have even been booked, let alone sent off. But
how does the ref check VAR and go, yeah, that's right?
It's very strange. I can understand why Messi's frustrated about that. It's incompetence on a significant scale.
And it was he was super quick with the red card as well. The referee just ran over and brandished it straight away.
Overall, the tournament has been a bit of a disappointment. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest talking point actually in the final was the Brazilian president Jair Bolsonaro was at the game and typically had his picture with the trophy and everything. But it was obviously he's a very controversial president, to say the least. Very far to the right. It was a question of who was kind of snubbing him when the medals were given out. Most of the players didn't. Marquinhos did. Marquinhos gave him a complete swerve, completely ignored him. But probably the enduring images of Chite, the manager, Bolsonaro goes to give him a hug and Chite's not having any of it. Just has his head down, kind of navel gazing, shrugs him off. And then he goes to the president of the CBF and gives him a big kiss and a big hug. And it was just really striking. And Chite wasn't involved in the picture with Bolsonaro. So this was kind of what got everybody talking and the reception that Bolsonaro got when he went onto the pitch. Big talking point in Brazil at the moment. It's a big reason. It's one of the many reasons lots of Brazilians feel conflicted about supporting the national team. Now they've got a very nationalist president. Lots of them won't wear the shirt and feel quite self-conscious about outward shows of patriotism. And this kind of, I mean, CONMEBOL shouldn't have let it happen, this kind of political point gaining with the president. But it added a bit of an angle to the final, probably more than the football itself.
Speaking of right-wing presidents, sad news for Donald Trump, because Mexico beat the USA. A, he has to invite the women to the White House, which is a big problem for him.
He did tweet congratulations.
Did he?
To them, yes.
Oh. Which so he's not all bad. Good old Don.
But it was spelled correctly,
yeah,
so
I don't
it
think
may
that
not
was his
may have been one of his handlers.
Handlers is the right word, isn't it? Mexico 1, USA 0. Jonathan Dos Santos scoring in the 73rd minute. So well done to Mexico. To AFCON now. And let's go live to Egypt and say hello to the Guardian's Nick Ames. Nick, how are you?
Hello, I'm okay. I'm in possibly the worst traffic jam I've ever been in my life, but that is part of the course now in Egypt after 3 weeks. So, yeah, that aside and all the general horns tooting around me, I'm fine.
And where are you going from and to?
I am going from the South Africa team hotel, where I've just been interviewing their manager, Stuart Baxter, which you should be able to see in The Guardian fairly soon, hopefully. And I'm going to the warmth and safety and sanctity of my apartment in Zamalek.
You mentioned South Africa. That huge shock that they beat Egypt.
Yes, incredible. I mean, they hadn't really looked like doing it at all. They came into the tournament, as the coach has just told me, actually fairly undercooked. They'd had their preparation cut in half, basically. Only one friendly where they played two different teams in 45-minute halves. And in their group stage, it sort of looked it, really. They toiled against the Ivory Coast and also Morocco. They squeaked past Namibia at the last minute. Nobody gave them a single fair against Egypt, even though Egypt were on fairly mediocre form performance-wise. And they went out there and they absolutely silenced them. They outplayed them for 45 minutes, created chance after chance, dominated the ball, pressed high, got behind them, kept Mo Salah very quiet. Second half, a little bit more even, I would say, but at the end, an absolutely rapid-fire counter-attack, superb piece of football, and the silence was quite something. I wasn't actually at the game. I backed the wrong horse. I went to Nigeria versus Cameroon, which was entertaining in its own way. But the way that stadium just hushed when the goal went in was quite eerie, and it was a remarkable night's football.
This is a question from Finnegan, who says, what does Nick make of Egypt's decision at 0-0 with 5 minutes to go to switch to a one-at-the-back formation?
Well, they certainly started pushing it a bit, didn't they? And I think we saw from the winning goal, which was superbly taken, that there may be four South Africans versus two Egyptians, when maybe you would want to hold extra time and hope your quality wins out. I think we saw in all of Egypt's performances here that the players felt under so much pressure, an almost unnatural and unhealthy amount of pressure, I think, to win and to take this trophy home and to bring something back to the country and the fans. And I just felt they buckled under it. I don't think they're that good a side. I think even in their group stage games, they were wading through treacle at times. They've obviously got an exceptional player in Salah. They never really looked like a team that could match the expectation put on them. And I think maybe towards the end of that game, they and also Aguirre, the coach who got sacked straight afterwards, got a bit carried away.
Yes, the manager was sacked, and then the Egypt FA president resigned, saying it was a moral obligation, which seems quite a... I mean, what a noble thing to do.
Yes, it was a bit like the end of a Shakespearean tragedy, wasn't it? Although, funny enough, I don't think too many people here felt it was a tragedy, to be honest. Most of the fans, pundits and journalists I've spoken to, albeit often quite middle-class and media-literate and woke, if you like, people, feel fairly glad that they got knocked out. There's not a lot of love for the team. There's a lot of feeling that the FA needs a hell of a spring clean. There's still a lot of anger, actually, about the Amber Wilder situation that we spoke about at quite a lot of length last week, with the sexual harassment allegations and his return to the team, which he came on the pitch as a substitute in the second half of the other day. He got a bit of a mixed reaction, and the feeling around a few people I've spoken to is that there's a bit of karma involved, possibly, that they've got knocked out this time. I personally think it's, if we look at it in a purely football tournament related perspective, it's fairly bad for the tournament that they're out. I don't think people can be that interested in the rest of it. The local fans certainly haven't been turning up to games for various reasons, a lack of interest for fan ID system here not really working, I think, in an African tournament that well. It's going to take a while to implement that properly. And, yeah, it's all a bit doom and gloom here, really, from an Egypt perspective.
Now, you were saying Morocco were the best team you'd see. So they duly went, got knocked out by Benin on penalties. And Madagascar through as well.
Yes, I made a series of absolutely rotten calls before the last 16. the only consolation is that I might not be alone. But yeah, I thought Morocco were going to power through. I thought we're going to see a lot more of Hervé Renard's flawless, creaseless white shirt, which was still pristine during the penalties, even when Bouffal and company missed. Madagascar have been a fantastic story. They really, really have. I was actually up at their team base for something just before the game, and I spoke to their manager, Nicolas Dupuis, who is French, and a bit like the team, almost a bit of a nobody who's come from nowhere. He was managing in the French lower leagues when he got the job in the fourth division. Nobody had ever heard of him before. He now has taken on alongside the Madagascar job another job in the French fourth division to pay the bills, because the FA can't really pay him properly. And it was interesting. It was quite nice, actually. I asked him how proud he felt having taken them at that point to the last 16. And he kind of reddened and blushed a bit, and he looked a bit emotional. And I thought, you don't see that often in football, you know, people sort of allowing themselves to sort of show that quite obvious pride in sort of not where on earth I am now. So I felt delighted that they won yesterday. It was a pretty amazing game, like a lot of these knockouts have been. They got pegged back in the 90th minute by Chancel Mbemba, and then we watched the DRC fluff their penalties. Yannick Bolasie among those to sky one, and the Madagascan celebrations were wild. And I you know, there's no reason why they can't go all the way on this form.
Well, look, thanks for coming on, Nick.
Thanks, Max. Cheers.
Nick Ames there, out at AFCON, and that'll do for part two. In part three, we will round up some mindless transfer gossip. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Gary says, are we still in last season or are we now into next season? I'm a bit confused. Where are you, Barry, on all of this?
I think we're still in last season.
Tomorrow, FK Sarajevo versus Celtic in the Champions League qualifier. God. St Joseph's versus Rangers in the Europa League qualifier.
Where are St Joseph's from?
Gibraltar. Mm-hmm. There they are. They're in Gibraltar. I mean, do you think we should have a gap year where all the footballers and all the broadcasters, we can all still get paid, but we all just go backpacking?
I've suggested that before.
So you're saying you want to get paid to go backpacking?
I want to go backpacking.
Who are you, Ben Fogle?
Yeah, why not? I mean, that's really anybody in broadcasting just wants to do travel docs, don't they? To be paid to go around the world. We could all take a footballer of our choosing and, you know, do the Inca Trail, do volunteer at an orphanage somewhere.
Who would you take?
I think I'd go with Jan Vertonghen. You?
I would probably choose Peter Crouch.
Okay.
I'd go with Gary Medel, just in case things got dicey somewhere.
Oh, that's
I'd
a good
really
idea.
Like a bit of protection.
Oh, I think Medel might lead you astray. anyway, good luck to Celtic and Rangers. Paul Pogba has gone to Australia with Manchester United on their pre-season tour. Australia, Singapore and China.
Man goes to work. Now news. This is where we are.
Well, there were rumours yesterday.
Was he wearing a backpack?
There were rumours that Man United didn't know where he was. Mino Raiola stated again he wants to leave United. What colour shirt will he be wearing at the start of next season? Lars Sivertsen.
The Juventus thing. I've been so wrong this week. When we did this on the radio a few weeks ago, you asked me to predict some things, and it's all gone wrong so far.
Oh,
so I've lost
okay.
my predicting confidence a little
okay.
bit.
So you don't want to have a stagger?
I think you've overcommitted to pernicketiness regarding the new handball rule. And it's affecting your mojo in other
areas.
But
the thing that's so confusing about Juventus is, where on earth are they getting money from, right? Because they've spent so much on Ronaldo and they're spending so much paying him. They've already got, like, Higuain's there on massive wages. They haven't shifted him yet.
They've got to spend money on De Ligt.
They've
right?
got some really, like, the free transfers they keep doing are great in terms of not spending transfer fees, but it means they end up with a pretty hefty wage budget, right? And it's they talk about them getting De Ligt in, and then they're also going to spend like 100 million plus on Pogba. Like, I just, like, where are they getting the money
and
from?
They've already got Ramsey and Rabiot this summer. So
another, yeah, with the wage budget. Yeah.
Midfield.
You wonder, I mean, presumably they're going to try really hard to shift Higuain. Maybe Dybala will be on the move. Khedira, that'll free up some wages. I mean, but it does make sense for him to go back to Juventus, I guess, because he seems very determined to get out of United. But what was reported certainly a while back was that Woodward was very keen to hold on to him. So, you know, we'll see.
Who wants to...
Yes. Sorry, I'm just holding out hope. What I think would not be a good idea, but really funny, if there was a Pogba-Neymar swap deal.
Oh, yes.
Just put Neymar there.
That would be tremendous.
In the club, yeah, where the sporting leadership is maybe not that strong to begin with. So,
would anybody like to me to read to them West Ham's statement on Marko Arnautović leaving?
Oh, it's very emotional.
West Ham United can confirm that Marko Arnautović has joined Chinese Super League champions Shanghai SIPG for an undisclosed fee. The 30-year-old Austrian departs after two seasons at London Stadium, during which he scored 22 goals in 65 appearances in claret and blue.
And if you scroll down a bit...
Is that passive-aggressive? I mean,
if you scroll down a bit, it says under West Ham TV, Chicharito, it's been a summer full of positives. So I guess...
Bournemouth have agreed to sell Tyrone Mings to Aston Villa for £26.5 million. I had a dream I was playing football with Tyrone Mings last night.
Okay.
Diego Costa to Everton, what do we reckon? I mean, sounds fun to me.
I think after, I don't know, after the time he's had at Atleti where he's been sort of injured and not scoring goals when he's been on the pitch, if you're Everton, is that where you want to spend like all your money? I think that's a bit of a weird one.
Could Everton sign Everton, the Brazil?
I think he might be beyond their means now, having kind of top scored at Copa America. I think quite a few big clubs will be after him. His nickname, by the way, Cebolinha, which means little onion. Because he looks like an onion.
Does he?
In what way?
How does that...
It's to do with his hair. Apparently there's an old Brazilian cartoon character called Cebolinha who has this like tufty hair.
Oh, right, okay.
So he looks like an onion.
Onion skin on.
Yes.
A skin on onion. Yeah. Salomon Rondon's following Rafa to China, apparently. And he says, why are Newcastle self-combusting? Mike Ashley, potentially? I mean, Rondon was never going to be there anyway, was he?
I think... He wasn't going to sign for Newcastle. He's a West Brom player, and well, Newcastle have their policy. Ashley would sort of be of a mind that he's too old to give a new contract to because he wouldn't have much sell-on value. So I think other clubs were interested in him, and yeah, he may well decide to go to China for the big bucks.
Speaking of China, Jose met China's richest man, which is nice, isn't it? Lots of speculation he was going to become the Chinese national coach or a manager for one of the Super League sides, but he isn't, apparently. He just met a rich man. So that's nice for you, Jose, isn't it? Arsenal looking at Ryan Fraser because they can't get Wilfried Zaha. Is he the answer, Tim?
No, I don't think so, to be honest. And it slightly worries me, this, because I think Fraser and Zaha, they play in the same position, but they're different players. It just kind of says to me, let's stick a pin in the middle of the Premier League and just see which winger comes out. I don't know, it has a touch of the Eddie McGoldricks to me.
Oh, he's better than McGoldrick. I wouldn't call McGoldrick a winger, I'd call him a right midfielder.
Yeah, quite possibly, but it's not one that enthuses me, to be honest.
Well done to the Cario Bangi Sharks, who have won the Sport Pacer Trophy after beating Everton 4-3 on penalties. The first Kenyan team to win a match against a Premier League side. Hashtag Everton in Kenya. Gigi Buffon has been given the number 77 shirt, which is not his age. I presume for the year he was born. Chesney offered him the number 1 shirt, but he turned it down, which is nice. Samir Nasri signed for Anderlecht.
The big Vinny company getting the band back together.
Oh, yeah. Who else could he get?
Yaya Toure, I think, is probably talking about somewhere.
Well, Yaya's gone to the Chinese second division.
Oh, damn it, sorry, I missed that.
That's okay. He's got
to Qingdao Wanghai.
He's gone to Qingdao Wanghai, and their kit is a really nice one. It sort of looks like essentially the Barcelona kit. That's what it is. He sent a tweet going, it feels great to be on the pitch doing what I love. So that's nice for Yaya. Here's a question for you, Barry, from Rich. Do David Healy's Linfield stand any chance against Rosenberg in the Champions League qualifiers?
I have absolutely no idea, because I have no idea whether David Healy's Linfield are any good or not, and I have no idea whether Rosenberg are any good or not.
They've not been great this season. It's not a bad time to play Rosenberg. They sacked their manager last year, mid-season, even though they were sort of on track they ended up winning the league and cup double again, but then they didn't give the job permanently to the interim manager who took them to a league and cup double, and they ended up not getting any of the managers they wanted in the winter. They got Hornland in, who's all right, but they've started the season quite badly. So
when would be the worst time to play Rosenberg?
Mid to late 90s, when they beat Dortmund away from home.
That Northern Ireland League is one I know nothing about, but I have an abiding memory of my youth was, you know, the Saturday sports results, and you'd eventually get this guy Jackie Fullerton would eventually get to, you know, the Northern Ireland results, and someone did a comedy sketch on it at this Apres match in Ireland, and, you know, the set was grey, the presenter was grey, and every result was a scoreless draw. It's like, Lorne nil, Distillery nil, Glenavon nil, Coleraine nil, and just quite funny.
Once, during the Soccer AM Glory years, we got a lot of trouble from Scottish football fans because all the goals in one week of the Scottish Premier League were set pieces, literally every one, and there were only about six, and we put it to the funeral march, because, you know, we normally put it to, you know, some upbeat hip hop or something that I didn't really follow. I'd like to apologise. It wasn't my idea. Matthew says, since Lee Catamol's now available, how much will you be offering him to join your shithouse 11 at Gillingham? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it'd be marvellous in there. Joachim says, what's the most...
Hold on a second. Lee Catamol is available?
Mm. Mm. Yes.
Oh, I hadn't heard.
I'm sorry, Barry. Why?
You just...
I think they're trying to get him off the wage bill, probably. He's on about 40 grand a week, I think. And, you know, that's quite a lot in League One.
I wasn't aware that his contract was...
Do you need to sit down?
No, I'm already sitting down.
Do you need, but do you need an extra, like a lie down?
Would you broke my head?
Joachim, what's the most overrated tourist attraction in London? I think we'll all be agreed on this.
Madame Tussauds.
I've always thought about Madame Tussauds. It would be really good if it was famous people being incredibly still.
I mean, credit to whoever came up with that idea and monetized it, because it's quite a... If you were to present that to the dragons on Dragon's Den, how far do you think you'd get?
I'm going to make dolls that look a lot like celebrities and then charge people a lot of money to watch them.
Do you feel like the pod is sort of coming to the end?
Yeah.
Adam Major says, with the Women's World Cup and Copa America reaching end, what will Football Weekly do for content now? A full-blown AFCON show, a fantasy series about the smoky, soaking Glendenning? Or, Barry, should we have some time away?
Could we have a holiday?
Yeah. Okay. And please look out for an announcement in your feed to remind you that we are coming back. And then when we do come back, listen to it. And
do a full episode just reading angry Yelp reviews of completely mundane things.
Yeah, I would enjoy it. Thanks for listening this season. And,
yes, thank you.
And do come again when the season starts again. Tim, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Cheers, Lars.
The Pacific Ocean has a 3.5 rating.
Go on, give us give us a one star.
Well, I think this is someone's taking the mic here, because it says too much water. Also, a shark ate me. I don't think that's...
To be honest,
too many waves, don't like it, ocean too wet. I mean...
What could have ended on a real high has suitably been a massive anticlimax.
Someone, 5 stars, it's an ocean, which, I mean, that's true.
Can somebody shut Lars up?
It's been 30
please.
Million years and I'm still trying to mop it up.
Stop talking!
We'll be back at some point, thanks.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.